people are turning more and more to public media sources like cable access channels and public programming at a time when funding for those exact sources are being pulled, or this recently this national franchise agreement stuff, which is going to eliminate the authority of municipalities.
It's another preemption.
To negotiate with cable companies and other media companies who want to do business in the municipalities, that's going to strip them of the ability to negotiate with those companies. That people are turning increasingly to other media than the corporate media, and that other media is being sapped now with funding shortfalls and everything else that's happening.
Also, what is a media corporation? The New York Times Corporation owns radio stations and TV stations and newspapers. It also owns forests. It owns paper mills. You know, it has other investments. Other corporations that have some media outlets, some people might say that they were pollution outlets and not media outlets, that they have nothing to do with ideas or news, that they're selling pollution and poison. They also have other businesses. So I'm not sure what a media corporation is. And we have a problem in this country in that the First Amendment wraps media corporations under its shield. And, you know, when is the New York Times Corporation a media corporation? When is it a paper corporation or a forest corporation? We have a... It's very hard to have a self-governing people in a self-governing country when the information flow and the news flow is so controlled by a handful of people. It's telling that back in the 1880s, the Knights of Labor, in their fundamental principles, called for that all transportation of knowledge must be publicly owned. And I think they understood exactly that you can't aspire to a democracy if you have the transportation of knowledge, if communications are in fact privately held. And sort of like having schools privately owned is also a problem, because you have enormous corporate influence both on public universities, public schools, and private schools, private colleges. I mean, we have a corporate state, so that sort of the corporate influence and dominance is everywhere. Every institution is organized in a corporate form. That's the dominant institution of our era. And it doesn't matter what field you're talking about. Every institution is sort of modeled on that same pattern. And it's enjoying and wielding the rights and authorities that have basically by 1900 were clothed around the corporate entity. I mean, we sort of joked that by 1900, the struggle was over in a sense, that the corporate state had been established. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult to even have this kind of conversation with people is that for the last century or so, there really hasn't been a major citizen uprising against the corporate state. That the uprisings have been against particular deeds, particular actions, particular corporations. But in terms of like the populace ran against the corporate state. They said, we cannot have a democracy. We cannot have even aspire to some of these ideals if, in fact, the transition from the slave state to the corporate state that's going on among us now in the 1880s and 90s comes to fruition. So they were very clear about that, and they structured their organizing to resist the coming of the corporate state. They were succeeded by what are called the progressives, who, in fact, one of the most misnamed movements in our history, they embraced the corporate state and saying the corporation, the major large corporations, would be the most efficient way to organize society, and they were inevitable anyway, and the best we can do is make them a little less bad. And they helped to blot out the history of the populace. But since the populace, with a few exceptions with the Wobblies and some socialist organizing here and there, we really haven't had a citizen movement that challenged the corporate state. And particularly since World War II, with the rise of the regulatory state in very exhaustive regular state, most civic opposition has been channeled into the regulatory, into dealing with regulations, and those are about trying to make the dominance and destruction of corporations a little less terrible. It's not about when you're in a regulatory struggle, you cannot say we don't want. You can't say no. You know, you're basically saying, we're going to try to make this a little less bad, and it's dueling data, and it's not in the language. It's scientists doing dueling data usually. You know, how much manure is a safe amount of manure? How much toxic release is a safe? How much radiation is safe or safe enough? Instead of our community is, in fact, rising up. A majority of the community is saying, no, this is not how we understand energy. This is not how we understand food. This is not what we want in our community in terms of food and energy and transportation and housing materials and all that. We have a very different vision for our community. We haven't had that fight. And that's a difficult struggle to plant the seeds for and to water and tend. And goes back to your question, nobody can predict what's going to happen here.
What was the question?
Here's another question. Some of the people that have been involved in these local ordinance rebellions in Pennsylvania, I would imagine that, like most people, they were raised to believe that they lived in a democracy, the freest country in the world, and now they've come down the road to this process. From what you can see from working with them for several years, how have they changed? And how much of their viewpoint and understanding of society and the way things happens has changed?
Well, first, I think it's never enough to be told that we don't live in a democracy, that people have to live it. And not necessarily that they have to go through it personally, but they have to see it somehow, see it happening, whether it's with their neighbors or other communities or other municipalities, whatever. And I think what happens is when you lose the grip on the assumption that we have a democracy, and you begin to understand that our job may be to build it or create it, that we didn't inherit anything, but we have to create it, I think that opens up new vistas in people's heads. And it means that they begin to trust people that normally they wouldn't trust. And for us to come in and build trust bonds, it's all been based on that, that their experiences have told them something. And we come in as translators in some ways, or facilitators, and say, you know, you're not the only one who's had that experience. You share it with X, Y, and Z in other places, and basically start bringing people together. In terms of a worldview that changes, I think it all fosters a collective sense of disobedience, that people get pissed. I mean, there's a real anger segment, that people are upset that they've been lied to, that they've been snookered, and that they're paying the price for other people snookering them. And I think that's a real resentment point, a real deep-seated anger that enables them to open up some boxes that were previously closed. And, for example, with this rights of nature stuff, you would think that rural Pennsylvania, local rural governments, would be the last place where you would see folks talking about the rights of nature. I mean, it'd be the absolute last place that you would think. But in a way, it makes sense, because when a corporation comes in to assault a community, right now the only thing that stands between the corporation getting its way or the people winning that battle is people's rights, the rights of people in the community that they try to assert. You know, they find out that those aren't as bold or aren't as true as they've always been told that they are. But the question is, how do we make ourselves stronger when a corporation is assaulting a community? And the fact is that the people don't live in a community by themselves. They live in it with the trees and the forests and the streams and all those other things that are being impacted with them at the same time. And so the question is, you know, how does it make sense to have rights of nature having rights? Well, it makes a lot of sense when people can defend those rights themselves, stand in the shoes of a mountain that's having its top blown off for mountaintop removal mining, or stand in the shoes of a stream that's been polluted, or stand in the shoes of a forest that's being clear-cut or affected in some other way. It actually makes people stronger. And so, in a way, when people understand that we don't have a democracy, it means that they're willing to start considering things that 5-10 years ago they would have thought were outlandish, or some kind of communist plot by an environmental group to take over the planet. But it makes a lot of sense to them in an experiential way, because they've been through it. And they understand that what we're talking about is actually the truth. It's not an agenda. It's not a sales plan. It's not any of those things. And they're more accepting. In fact, not only more accepting, but they're the ones driving this stuff. And so talking about rights of ecosystems, which is something you wouldn't expect, they're doing it. And they're doing it because they're looking for ways to make themselves stronger to build the type of world that they need to build at the community level. And that's what's so exciting about this work, is because it opens up new windows for new tools and new vehicles that people start playing with when they understand that we don't have a democracy in this country.
Also, the country is not so homogeneous. I mean, African Americans in general, we certainly see it with African Americans who come to democracy. They don't have to be persuaded. I mean, they were once property. I mean, they have a different history. And so what they believe, what this country is all about, is not quite as as self-evident as white people. People who lived in New Orleans have had an experience and are learning from that. Coal miners in West Virginia, in Pennsylvania, they've had their experience. I mean, hope springs eternal, and the truth, you know, one's feet, one is grown up to be taught, dies hard. But it happens. I mean, the military families, little by little, some of them are changing their view of things because of what's going on now. Every community has something going on. I mean, the country is under siege, particularly rural America. I mean, to sustain this global industrial system means that rural parts of this country and other countries, I mean, it's happening in China now, it's happening all over the world, that the rural communities have to be uprooted and dumped on. It takes an extraordinary... I mean, it's one of the... I lived in Pennsylvania for only 15 months, and from moving from New Hampshire. And it's a very... From New Hampshire, which has got its problems, but it's not an industrial state. It never was an industrial state. It's a bucolic rural state with a small population and not a lot of industry. And so the structure of the state is not conducive. It hasn't been molded over the last 150 years to be that kind of state. So it's a pretty much live and let live state with a lot of problems. You move from there to Pennsylvania, which was the dominant corporate state for decades and decades and decades up to the 1950s and 60s, industrial corporate state. The whole default system of the culture and the law is about enabling corporations to do whatever they want to run the state. I mean, it's just, you know, to an outsider, it was absolutely apparent from the first couple of weeks that I moved there. The massive transportation system to allow trucks to go from west to east and east to west and north to south in order to take raw materials out and to dump, bring the dump stuff back into the state is enormous. The whole mindset of public officials from most towns, uptown, county, the state, it's all about more and more and more. And the only choice we have is to be kind to corporations, give them more subsidies, get out of the way and let them do this. It's the only way we can get jobs. It's the only way we can do things. It's just an extraordinary mindset to live in a community like mine, you know, riddled with hydrogen sulfide and ammonia gases and all kinds of poisons that's importing 200,000 tons a year of animal excrement in which to grow the mushrooms. And people go around saying it's the smell of money. I mean, you're going around gagging and people saying it's the smell of money. And it's a whole community living in denial. You know, and then the experts come and say, well, you don't smell anything and it's not hurting your health. It's okay. Don't worry about it. And, you know, there's not riots in the street. Because, you know, it goes back to your other question. What does it take for people to actually follow their convictions? It's in every part of the country there's stuff going on and there's resistance. And when that resistance, as I said before, when and how that begins to congeal in different ways and becomes, you know, bigger than what it is and starts to escalate, is impossible to predict. At least one of the things that we're talking about here is that you can't, if you people have aspirations for changing their communities and changing the way things are done, we can't get there from the way that we've been doing things. And that means challenging, you know, what we've been taught. It's challenging the law. It's challenging the culture. It's challenging even the culture of organizing that's grown up in the last 30, 40 years. It's challenging the major institutions, environmental and labor institutions particularly, which are as complicit, the national institutions that are as complicit in this corporate state as the corporations themselves. And so, you know, there's a lot at stake. It's very scary to people, and rightly so.
And since you've been doing the democracy schools throughout the country, have you yet seen their impact in the mix of rebellion and organizing?
Oh, absolutely.
If you could give an example as to how they've impacted some particular situation.
I think they're impacting people's brains right now in terms of the way that they think. And we're just now starting to have some of these emerging campaigns, like in New Hampshire, where this town, folks went back to the Barnstead, New Hampshire, who had come to a democracy school down in Pennsylvania, and went back and actually put a campaign on the ground. And now it's become a groundbreaking place, first community to ban corporations from withdrawing water, instead of screwing around with permits or gallons of water. You know, it just says, no corporation shall withdraw water here in the town. And so they're making a stand. And that stand was only... they were only able to make that stand in the way that they did and build the campaign in the way that they have because of the democracy schools. And in other places, the democracy schools have bred more democracy schools because they need to spread. I mean, every town has to have a democracy school or some kind of institution that brings people together to talk and explore these issues. And that's the huge job that's ahead of us. Because some democracy schools, people come and then they say, well, geez, we need this for our community group. We need to have this democracy school. And so then the democracy school gets transported, you know, exported out to that small community. Pennsylvania, we're now doing 14 county one-day democracy schools. They are, in essence, what's happening through the process, communities are arising within those counties and then coming to us to work with them, to do ordinances and do work in a different way.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Grossman of POCLAD and Tom Lindsay of CELDEF, founders and teachers of democracy schools. New York's third school took place this weekend in Ithaca. The next session will be held in Rochester on the weekend of July 14th, and more schools are planned in the Albany area, the North Country, and back here in the Finger Lakes in Yates and Steuben County over the coming months. To find out how to participate, visit celdef.org, that's celdf.org, and click on Democracy Schools. You can also reach CELDEF's site through a link on our website, unwelcomeguests.org. For our listeners around the country, check out the site too, because democracy schools are being held in many states, and you can also start one in your community. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. In the second half of the program, we're going to pick up on one of the threads mentioned in the interview, the issue of water privatization, something of particular concern here in the Northeast. Capitalism is called the free market, but it's not about free or freedom. It's about creating scarcity through law. For example, people are not homeless because there are no homes. They are homeless because they have no money to buy or rent homes and are denied access by law for the same reason to vacant land where they could gather materials and build a home for themselves. Even a rat living in a city sewer has more freedom to live than most of the people in the city above who are under this so-called free market system. In order for capitalists to get profits, they have to sell more and more of something to somebody somewhere. There are a limited number of people with the money to buy new cars and big screen TVs. In order to create new investment opportunities, capitalists seek to create through law the means to force people to enter the market by making them pay for what they once had freely. This is one of the motives behind the so-called free trade agreements. Access to fresh water is the new profit frontier, and the hammer has already come down hard in the global south. In India, Coca-Cola established a bottling plant that extracted so much water from the aquifer that the residents' wells have run dry. And the WTO treaties gave Coca-Cola the right to do this under the rubric of free trade. In Bolivia, one of the things that led to the recent election of President Evo Morales was a war over water. A previous corrupt government privatized the water in the city of Cochabamba and gave ownership of it to the U.S.-based Bechtel Corporation, which was supposed to provide water services. As a result, residents were forced to pay Bechtel for water, and even collecting rain from their roof became illegal. Unbelievable, but true. And Bechtel then jacked up the water rates to figures amounting to half the monthly income of many families. The people rose up, threw out Bechtel, and now, under the WTO rules, Bechtel is demanding billions of dollars from Bolivia for their lost profit. Can't happen here? Don't be so sure. Next, Canadian water rights activist Maud Barlow talks about the coming water wars in North America. After her speech, I'm going to tell you how to get involved here in the Finger Lakes with people who are organizing to bolt the barn door on the privatization of our water before it's too late. So you have about 50 minutes to get something to write with. The talk you're about to hear by Maud Barlow was delivered earlier this year in British Columbia.
Now, it's my pleasure to introduce Maud Barlow. She is a national chair of the Council of Canadians, founder of the Blue Planet Project, 2005 winner of the alternate Nobel Prize, and the recipient of Sweden's Right Livelihood Award, to name a few. Maud and the Council of Canadians have been noted across Canada for their support of publicly owned and operated regulated water and water services. Maud is also the director of the International Forum on Globalization. Please help me in welcoming Maud Barlow.
Thank you so much. Thank you so very much for this absolutely beautiful introduction and welcome. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Sue. Thank you to the Oceanside Coalition for Strong Communities. Thank you to all of the groups here. The Council of Canadians works very, very closely with the Canadian Union of Public Employees and many of the groups involved here, Kairos, equality groups around the country, and it's just a thrill to be here, and I thank you so much for that warm welcome, and I thank you so much for coming out tonight and being here. I've come to support you 100% in your fight against EPCOR, and I find it distressing to hear when I hear that, I mean, I find it good to hear that 92% of people on the island don't want your public services removed. But I also know, and I've been fighting this for quite a long time now, that doesn't matter one bit to the people who've decided to privatize your water. You have to understand, this has nothing to do with what you want. This has absolutely nothing to do with democracy. This is about the intention of some corporations and some private sector interests around the world to privatize every single drop of water in the world, every single drop of available fresh water, which is actually a very small amount of water systems. And I want you to know that this is not a case of, well, if we just assert ourselves and show democratically that we want to keep water in the public sector, these companies will go away. That's not what's happening around the world. These companies don't care what you think. It's not about democracy. It's about their power. So we have to understand the nature of the struggle as we start it. I'm going to come back to your struggle here, but I wanted to start a little bit out in the world, if we could, and that is, I think it's important to put the work that you're doing here on Vancouver Island, because I can promise you the issues that you've got on French Creek and other places are just the beginning of a fight over your island's water resources. I can tell you now, it's just the first baby steps of a huge fight that we're going to have in years to come. And I want to kind of put it in a perspective of what's happening around the world. It's very important for us to see this as part of something very, very large and, in my opinion, part of the greatest environmental and human rights crisis of our times. There are two kind of concerns, if you will, or two parts to the concern around water in the world. The first is that we are actually running out of water. Now, that's not supposed to be able to happen, right? We all learned back in grade 2 or grade 8 or whatever that there's a closed hydrologic cycle, and there's a certain amount of finite amount of water, and it'll circulate through the environment and through the air and so on, and come down in the form of rain, and we use it, and it goes back up into the system. And you know what I think it's when you think about water, when you next walk out into the rain, which might be tonight, it's important to remember that not only is that water the same amount of water that was here at the beginning of the planet, but it's actually the same water. So some of the water that falls on you the next time it rains, just stop and think, was once circulating through the blood of dinosaurs. I mean, that's what the continuum is in our lives. But what we didn't understand, and what our teachers weren't able to tell us because they didn't know, is that it's possible to take that water, that very, very small percentage, it's less than 0.5% of all the world's water stock, and make it unusable. And what's happening around the world is that humanity is depleting, polluting, and diverting the surface water systems of the world so fast that it's running out of surface water. It's not that the water's not there, but it's not usable. or either because we're polluting it, or perhaps we're taking it from somewhere like a large body of water and using it for corporate agribusiness. So we're spreading it out over fields. So we're taking it from a place that's accessible and putting it in a place that's not. We know that what's happened now then as a result of that, and I'll just give you two examples, China and India. 75% of India's surface waters and 80% of China's surface waters are so polluted that they're not usable for anything, fishing, cooking, drinking, anything. So we're using these huge bores, these industrial bores, and we're putting them down into the groundwater systems, the aquifers under the ground, and we're taking up groundwater faster than nature can replenish it, very much faster than nature can replenish it. And this is very, very recent. Only in the last 30, 40 years have we been able to access this water in a way that is not like a farmer using a well. This is actually going into groundwater systems. One example would be the Ogallala Aquifer, which is considered probably the biggest in the world. It runs through under the American Midwest. They have 200,000 bores cycling water out of the aquifer 24/7, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And depending on which study you look at, the aquifer is being depleted 8 to 14 times faster than it can be replenished. And nobody's arguing that it will come to an end, and it will come to an end, for some people feel it will come to an end sooner than anyone is ready for. And so the scientists talk about what they call hot stains, and that is that there are parts of the world that are actually running out. And I cannot say this strongly enough. It's not cyclical drought. The Middle East, northern China, where 400 of the 600 cities are now living with serious drought, serious water scarcity. And this is because they've taken all the water that's used to be used to grow grain in the Chinese breadbasket, and they're diverting it to industry so that all your running shoes and shower curtain liners and everything else can be made there. This is to pay for their economic miracle. They are absolutely destroying the water tables of China. 22 countries in Africa, Mexico City, which is actually sinking in on itself, and the United States. And I want to take a few seconds on the United States because I want to return to the United States in terms of Canada. But it's very important that we understand that there is a huge water scarcity building up in the United States. Last year, the National Academies of Science and the U.S. Geological Survey put out a very powerful study, and they said that what's happening in the interior west of the United States is very, very, very frightening. They said that it's the driest it's been in 500 years, that it is not a cyclical drought, that they are, in fact, in far worse shape than they were in the 1930s, the only difference being after the crisis of the Dust Bowl years, they built in reservoir systems in order to save water in times between droughts. California, Idaho, Kentucky, Oregon, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Florida are all in crisis. There's a new study from the University of Chicago that shows that demand in the Chicago basin is going to dramatically increase. And there are those of us living around the Great Lakes who are very concerned with the new annex, a new proposal to remove new water diversions from the Great Lakes by the governors of the states that border the Great Lakes. And they're going to be taking massive new amounts of water from the Great Lakes. We look to the Aral Sea and say, you know, people say it couldn't happen here, but in fact, the drying up of a whole body of water could have, in fact, indeed happened. And it's getting worse. We know that the hot stains that the scientists talk about now also include potentially the removal of some of the water, actual water systems from the hydrologic cycle. So that's on one side is scarcity, and on the other side is water injustice or water inequality, because there are parts of the world and parts of the classes of the world that have all the water that they need, of course, and there are parts of the world that are going without. We have about 1.2 billion people in the world without access to clean water now, and it's getting worse. And of course, we know that most of those people live in the third world, and it is not just connected to places without water. In Latin America, for instance, there's so much fresh water that the allocation per capita should be the highest in the world. It's one of the lowest in the world. Because of massive pollution and massive inequality, some people have access to all they want, and many people have access to none. The United Nations, the World Bank, the Pacific Institute, the World Watch Institute all tell us that by 2025, unless we dramatically change the current rate of depletion of our water systems, that two-thirds of the world's population will not have access to clean water. Of that, half will actually be living in a dire situation without any access whatsoever. Now, it's no surprise, then, that some private interests around the world have suddenly come to discover this. And this is all fairly recent in terms of their research was there in this part of the world, in this part of the world, in this part of the world, but it's only recently that scientists have begun to put this together as a global picture and are beginning to understand that it's possible to actually destroy the world's fresh water tables. So we think about running out of oil, but we can't imagine that we could run out of fresh water. In fact, we are running out of fresh water. And so these companies have discovered what I call blue gold, and that is that water is the most precious commodity and is going to become more precious and more rare in the future, and whoever controls it will be both powerful and wealthy. And there are several types of what I call water hunters, because I consider these folks to be a kind of predator on water. And I consider water, I agree with Roger, water is not like running shoes or cars. Water is necessary to life, and I deeply believe should be removed from the market system altogether. There's water services, which is what you're dealing with here in this community with EPCOR, and that is that there are three big companies, though. You're still dealing with the small potatoes to an extent, although these companies can get bought out. The three biggest are Suez, Vivendi, and RWE Thames. They're all European. They're huge. They have hundreds of thousands of employees. They're growing at a rate of about 10% a year. They're growing faster than the countries, the growth rate in most of the countries in which they operate. They are backed by the World Bank that now goes into developing countries and says, you know how we told you to privatize healthcare and how we told you to privatize education? If you wanted more structural adjustment funds or more funds to develop your programs, well, we're going to come in and tell you now that if you want any money for water services, you have to bring in one of these corporations. And the companies around from Africa, all through Asia, all through Latin America, there are huge fights going on against these corporations that have been in some countries for as long as 30 years, delivering water on what they call cost recovery, full cost recovery, which is, of course, meaning that they have to get not only all the money that they, or more specifically the World Bank, put up in return, but they have to get anywhere between a 10 and 20, in some cases 30% return of profit for their overseas investors. And the World Bank is now signing agreements with these corporations, actually promising them that whether they make this money or not, the World Bank is still going to guarantee them this kind of profit. These people are thugs. I will give you one example. I've got dozens and dozens. I just got back from Bolivia in the spring. Bolivia has had a number of water wars. The most recent is that Suez, the big French company that built the Suez Canal, is given the right, the contract through the World Bank to deliver water to the people of La Paz, which is the capital of Bolivia. Now, Bolivia is the poorest country in Latin America, 75% indigenous. There's communities in the hills around La Paz called El Alto. And Suez came in and it signed an agreement that it would deliver water to everybody, not just to the rich. It promised, this was in the contract, and it signed a contract that it would bring in infrastructure, put millions and millions of dollars into infrastructure and build a wastewater treatment so that pollution wouldn't be as rampant in the communities. What they've done, and I've been there, I've seen it with my own eyes, they have built a great big plant under a mountain, under a snow melt. And they literally take the snow melt coming off this mountain as if they somehow produced it, worked hard and produced this snow, and they get to make money from it. And they have a very crude device of just separating the runoff from the twigs and the dirt and the rocks and so on, because there's no chemicals they have to worry about. And that's what the local indigenous community gets to take. And there are 200,000 of them with absolutely no access to water. And they pipe the good water that comes off, the clean water that they've now cleaned off through this process, in a huge pipe, and they sell it to people who can afford it in La Paz, and they are not selling it to anyone who has not got the money. And there are children dying in these communities because they have suddenly been cut off water that was their water for centuries and centuries. They also did not put in their infrastructure. They built kind of canals through the poorer parts of the city, and they're just throwing the garbage and the raw sewage, and in one particular canal I saw the filth from the abattoirs, local abattoirs, and they're going directly through people's communities. I was there, I saw it, I saw dogs eating food from the abattoir rivers going right into Lake Titicaca, which is a World Heritage Site and one of the most beautiful places on God's earth, which will be destroyed, they say, within 3 years. I was so angry with what I saw there. I was so breathlessly angry. I had a British television crew following me around, and I said, what's happening here is murder. Suez is committing murder here. And he turned the camera off and he said, would you like to rephrase that? And I said, unless you can think of a stronger way that I could put it, actually, no. And then he said, we'll see if our lawyers let it get through. And I am very much hoping that the lawyers let it get through, because we have to name what this is that we're dealing with. That's one kind of theft, and it's all over the place, by the way. These companies are in real trouble in the developing world because there has been such a fabulous fight back, and I'll talk to you about the exciting fight back in a minute, but now they're moving into North America. I was just in Lexington, Kentucky, where RWE took over their local water system, raised the rates. That company is totally now controlled by a German, or their local water supply is controlled by a German conglomerate that doesn't care at all about the people in Lexington. So it was kind of interesting to hear people in the United States saying the same kind of thing that people in Bolivia were saying, and feeling taken over by these, you know, corporate interests from far away, and feeling that their democratic rights have been taken away. And I thought, you know, we have a lot more in common with ordinary Americans. It's the elites of our countries that are giving us grief, and it was just a very interesting kind of observation for me to see. Then there's bottled water. And bottled water is a huge and growing and very unregulated industry. There are three big companies. The big three are Nestle, which owns about 78 companies, including Perrier and San Pellegrino. I bet you think San Pellegrino comes from a lovely little spring in Italy somewhere. It's more likely to come from Lake Michigan, you know. And they're hunters. Nestle is a very strong hunter. And then Coca-Cola and Pepsi, who are both producing water as fast as they can. They take tap water. These companies do not take spring water. They put it through what they call their secret reverse osmosis process and add their secret mineral packet, and they sell it back to you at almost 2,000 times what it would have cost you to come out of to drink it out of the tap. And there have been studies that show that it's not only not particularly safer, in many cases it's less regulated or more unregulated than the tap water you're getting out of your tap. But what's so dangerous about this is that last year we put close to 100 billion liters of water in plastic bottles around the world. And those plastic bottles, those containers are being thrown into wetlands and, you know, our oceans and our lakes, and in huge piles, again, shipped to the third world, or who the hell cares what happens to them, and where they leach their toxins, because plastic is toxins and oil, right? And when they break down, and they take a long, long time to break down, they're leaching back into water. So the very notion of the purity of the water in this bottle is negated by the fact that the container is poisoning our water as well. And then we have people who are just coming in and buying up water systems. T. Boone Pickens, you probably have heard of, the millionaire from Texas. Everything is for sale, except, you know what, they're having this reaction to the fact that one of their own is just buying up all the water he can and hoarding it until the day that it just zooms up in price and he's going to sell it for whatever he can. And even in the heart of George Bush's Texas, people are beginning to ask some questions, so they asked me to come down. Or you get these companies coming into Latin America and they're actually buying up huge tracts of land where they know there's water underneath and they're just holding on to it. Ontario, where I come from, we around Guelph, around that whole area, there are water companies going from farm to farm to farm saying, what are you bothering to work so hard sunrise to sunset and pass? Why don't you just let us put a little straw down in your water and we'll pay you very, very good royalties for access to your water. They're literally going farm to farm. Nobody is minding the store. Nobody has any idea how much groundwater is down there or what's acceptable to take. And in most of our provinces, we're just giving this water away for free. It's just a kind of a stunning thing. So I think you're going to find the same fight is going to take place here on this island. So this is, in my opinion, one of the most important growing debates of our time. This is one of the most intense and politically charged debates. This conference I was at in Lubbock, they kept talking about the compromise that we have to come to. And there was a guy, vice president of Coca-Cola, who's meeting up with fierce resistance in India because Coke is using the satellite imagery from the American military to find out where all the water, underground water sources are. And then they're saying, then they're putting that together with the demographic analysis of where poor tribal communities are, and they're going in and they're just draining the groundwater. Well, there's a ferocious fight back. And the guy from Coca-Cola got up and said, now isn't there a compromise somewhere? And I said, you mean the local people, the local tribes who've lived with that's been their sacred water and the water to feed them and their families for since the back of time? You think there's a compromise with a large transnational corporation that comes in, puts up a great big fence, armed guards, snarly dogs, barbed wire around their water source and tells them to get out and don't come back, and takes all that water for their own personal financial gain and for foreign investors? Where's the compromise that you expect the local community to make there? What compromise would you be asking? This image of barbed wire around water is just so in my head. One more story and then I'll stop with the stories, but Mexico City is running out of water, so they are going farther and farther and farther away to get it. And I was recently in a community, very, very poor local indigenous people who depend on that water, and the water is not just a bottling plant or like the plant in Bolivia where they were actually sorting the snow from the dirt from the snow. This is just a water source. It's a place where the water, it's a spring, the source of a very big river. And they've actually put huge military-style security around this water source. And it's been taken. It's just been appropriated for the people of Mexico and the local indigenous communities. And we're not talking 10 people here. We're talking millions of people in this rural area have just been told, we're sorry, you have no access to this water. They're literally, it just made me weep. They took me, one community showed us where they're learning how to catch rainwater because they're not allowed to access their own water systems anymore. This is happening all over the world now as we speak. There are basically two fundamental sides to it. On one side, you have the big water companies, you have the World Bank, you have the World Trade Organization, you have the development agencies of northern countries, Canada, the Canadian Investment Development Agency, CETA, our International Development Agency. CETA is very much on the pro-privatization side. The European Union, because their companies are, you know, they want to make money for their company. So that's on one side. And their argument is water is just a commodity like anything else. Put it on the open market, let the highest bidder get it, and, you know, Bob's your uncle. On the other side is a growing movement around the world of local communities and people, environmentalists, human rights activists, people concerned with health, small farmers, indigenous peoples who are saying, you can't steal this water. Nature put it where it belongs, and you can't just take it. And you can't take it for profit, and you can't take it from us. And this is a very, very powerful struggle that's taking place around the world, and it's of which I might add, you have now become a part, right? Now, bring this back to Canada, because I want to talk about what's happening here. The Canadian government's and the provincial, but just to start with the Canadian government's position on water is pathetic. I have no words strong enough to describe how awful our national stewardship of water is. Not only are we polluting water, not only are we not caring for our water, not only are we not protecting watersheds, but we have no national water policy. Go to the Environment Canada website and you type in national water policy, up will come a description of a proposed water policy and a photograph of the Minister of the Environment, Tom McMillan, from 1987, Brian Mulroney's first environment minister, I kid you not, with royal Tory blue in the background, with a proposed water policy that they never passed. And then there's a note saying, somebody wrote this up. Now, it says, obviously, this is a little dated, and it isn't Canadian policy, but there's some interesting thoughts here for you to look at. That's what the little note says. I'm not making this up. You couldn't make this up. There's a recent internal Environment Canada assessment that was sent to the Prime Minister that someone got a hold of in terms of using access to information. And this internal confidential memo was just released in May or leaked in May of this year, saying that there is a national water crisis looming in this country, that it is not true that we have unlimited amounts of water. There's a crisis coming on the prairies. There's a crisis in pollution. This study said we have no idea how much groundwater we have. We have no idea where it is. Nobody is minding the story. It is a very, very powerful statement from this memo from Environment Canada to the Prime Minister. However, we do have a very important piece of legislation governing water, and it's called NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. This is how I got started on this issue. Way back in the mid-1980s, we were looking at the first free trade agreement, the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, and we said it includes water as a good. And John Crosby, who was then the Minister of Trade, and I don't have, some of you may remember this, some of you who are old like me would remember that he used to go around boasting that he'd never read the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement. He thought that was funny. This is our trade minister who promoted this, who brought us this agreement. He used to think that was very funny. Well, it's clear he hadn't read it. And they said at the time, there's no word of water in there. That's true. When you go to NAFTA, which picked up the same language, you won't see the word water. What you have to do is look under the definition of good. And they say that the definition of good was adopted from an old treaty called the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. And there it is, water in all its forms, including snow and ice, is included, which means that once you start to trade in water, the same provisions that now apply for energy, which is that we can't turn the tap off, would apply for water. You would not be allowed to stop the supply of water to the U.S. or to another NAFTA partner once that was started. As well, water was added as an investment when we signed NAFTA, and so a corporation that can prove that it's put some investment into water supplies would have every right to sue for compensation. For instance, there are huge American energy companies in the Athabasca tar sands who are using and wasting and destroying tons and tons and tons of water. For every unit of oil that's extracted from the tar sands, because it's a mining operation, they need to separate the oil from the sand, one equal unit of water is lost to the hydrologic cycle, right? And if any government, dream along with me, that a government in Alberta would care about this and not want the Athabasca, you know, system dried up in 10 years, dream along that we might have a federal provincial government together that would say to these companies, you can't destroy Alberta's water table. They would have the right under NAFTA's Chapter 11 to say, you can't change the rules now. We have access, permanent access, to the amount of water we have been having access up until now. And if you doubt me, look at the energy provisions and look what we said about it and look what's happened. We are sending almost 70% of our oil to the United States. Under NAFTA's proportional sharing agreement, we are required to continue to do that. So in order to supply our own needs, we are now importing half of our oil needs in this country. You want to know why your bills are high? Why aren't we angry about this? Why are we not taking to the streets? If this were a lawyer for a corporation who had signed that kind of agreement, that corporation would have fired that lawyer for signing that agreement. And yet you get the big business community in this country continuing to say how wonderful it is. And by the way, if EPCOR is successful in getting these water rights in this community, and then it was bought out by an American corporation or an American subsidiary of one of the big three under NAFTA, you could never reverse it. They would have permanent rights. You'd at least, as long as the company is Canadian, you could still make rules around it, but you'd have no right if it were taken over by a Canadian company. Now, there's a myth in this country that we have water, 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 and I know I'm standing in a place that does rain sometimes. And it's hard, and we're surrounded by oceans and lovely lakes, and it's hard to think that maybe there's a shortage, and I won't say there's a shortage, but we do not have the surplus of water that people talk about. You go onto Environment Canada website, and they say we have 20% of the world's fresh water. That's if you drained every single lake and took all our rivers and drained it and left us with nothing. Available water that we don't hurt the ecosystem is around 8% of the world's water. So it's a healthy amount, but it is not 20%. And most of that water is in huge rivers running north. So if we were to divert and start to shift massive amounts of water to the United States, we would be talking about major, major environmental engineering projects that would make the Three Gorges Dam in China look small. I mean, what they're talking about is absolutely huge. Now, are they talking about water? Well, I'll tell you, in my travels in the United States, I have become absolutely convinced that the United States is planning to come to Canada for our water. It's as clear as a bell to me. What I'm doing this week is not so much talking about water. I am here tonight. I'm out talking about something else, which is part of the issue. I'm talking about deep integration with the United States, and I'm talking about the book I just wrote called Too Close for Comfort, Canada's Future Within Fortress North America. And I'm trying to talk to Canadians about the fact that in last March in Waco, Texas, right near George Bush's ranch, Vicente Fox of Mexico, George Bush of the United States, and Paul Martin of Canada sat down and signed a far-reaching partnership called the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. And it is based almost identically, or almost totally, on a blueprint, a report and recommendations that was put out 2 years earlier by the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, which used to be called the Business Council on National Issues, which is Tom DiCino and the 150 big corporations. And they are saying post 9/11, we have to offer up to the United States all sorts of changes to the way we do business in order to keep that border open, because now the U.S. is so concerned about security. So they're offering up, and we have agreed. You need to read the agreement that was signed by these three governments. We have agreed to harmonize all sorts of areas in Canada, including immigration and refugee policy, including entry policy for North America, including security, one security policy, one security perimeter around North America. We have set up what they call interoperability for our defense in our country, and I don't know if you know that we just increased our defense budget to about $20 billion a year, which is the highest per capita since the Second World War, and it's not to pay the men and women of the armed services a decent wage. It's to buy the technology to make us interoperable with George Bush and his move to, continue to increase his defense spending. Get me off on this and I won't get back to water, but they are going to spend US $1 trillion in the United States this year between their military budget and their war on terror. $1 trillion. They're sucking up everything from their people. Infrastructure, environmental protection, human rights protection, social security. They've cut welfare by 13% every single year since he came to power in the year 2000. You don't want to be a middle class or poor American right now, because you would live in the United States, you live in the country with the greatest income inequality in the world, greater than Mexico, greater than any country in Africa, greater than any country in Asia. The United States has just become the most unequal, class-divided country in the entire world. And we have just signed an agreement to merge our food and health standards, our standards around seeds and seed production. We've agreed to harmonize what are our regulatory regimes around the environment. We have signed a far-reaching agreement, so we're trying to sound the alarm at the Council of Canadians, because we want a national debate, and we want other voices in this debate besides the big business community. What does this have to do with water? Well, everybody denies that water's on the table. I debated Tom DeKino not long ago, and he said, you're just making that up. And I pulled out the leaked minutes of one of the meetings of this task force that had been set up. It was called the Task Force on the Future of North America, just reported a few months ago. The Canadian co-chairs were John Manley, who was Chrétien's deputy minister, who wants to be prime minister, who's a real hawk vis-a-vis the United States, and Tom DeKino, the head of this Canadian Council of Chief Executives. And the leaked minutes of the document, which we've got up on our website, say very clearly, we all agree that water will one day be on the table, but it is too delicate and sensitive an issue right now to put out there politically. But water will be negotiated one day between our three countries. And I debated Paul Cellucci on the current last week, and he was the former American ambassador to Canada. He started off saying, why are you people so funny about your water? You've given your energy away to us. Well, why is your water so sacred? And I said, you just answered your own question. Why would we want to do with our water what we just did with our energy? So I am deeply convinced that we are in a very dangerous situation now vis-a-vis all of our resources, with a resource-hungry United States, with an extraordinarily right-wing and, I think, dangerous administration, with no regard for anything but its own powerful needs, and one that, by the way, intends to weaponize space. And don't listen to me, listen to them, because they say it every time anyone asks. And that really sees Canada in terms of our resources and political acquiescence. That's what's required here, and I am deeply concerned about what that will mean on many fronts, and also around, of course, water. So we need to protect, we need to fight, and I would say to you here tonight that one of the things we need is to fight this deep integration agenda, this creation of this Fortress North America. And we're calling for a moratorium on this. We're calling for a Canadian made in Canada energy policy, a national water policy. We want our health care protected and preserved and not privatized. And we say that the United States broke NAFTA with what it did on softwood lumber, and we are no longer obliged to continue to abide by it. On water, we want a National Water Act that would exempt water now and forever from all trade agreements. We want binding rules to stop the pollution of our water systems, be it corporations, forestry companies, agribusiness, the intensive livestock operations, and so on. We want a prohibition against the privatization of water. We want it understood that water belongs to Canadians, it belongs to local communities, it belongs to the earth and all species, and must not be expropriated for profit by private interests. And that needs to be put into the constitutional law of the land. I've been working on lately that's given me great joy, and I'm going to end with just telling you this little piece of work that we're doing, and then we can talk as long as you want. I'm totally energized. And that is that there's a group of us that have formed called Friends of the Right to Water. Now, this is a very important concept, because the World Bank and the other So on that side, have formed something called the World Water Council. And the World Water Council tries to act as if it's the United Nations body, but it isn't. It's the private interests of the water industry. And they have a World Water Forum every 3 years. Two times ago, it was in The Hague. in March 2000, and then March 2003 it was in Kyoto, and it's going to be in Mexico City this March, and we're going to be there as a very organized opposition, and I can tell you the Mexicans are going to be there in huge numbers. But they come together and they refuse to admit that water is a human right. So this isn't a semantic thing. They say water is a human need, and anybody can provide that need. They say, oh, sometimes it's the public, and sometimes it's the private, and sometimes it's public-private partnerships. And they love this notion of stakeholder partnerships, as if somebody can be partners, a poor community can be partners with a multinational, a transnational that's in the top 20 of the Fortune 500 corporations in the world. But they like to talk about stakeholders as all being equal. And we're going to be there. We were there very powerfully in Kyoto. We've got people, there would be huge rooms like this, and we would get our people to the mics, and there would be people up at the top of the room not looking like us, very powerful presidents of these corporations. And I won't ever forget this man from Cancun, Mexico, got up and he had two bottles of water. And he's a worker in a five-star hotel, and that he lives in a poor community in the community that where all the workers live there. And he held up the water, and Suez is delivering water. All of it's privatized in Cancun. And he said, you deliver water in the place where I work and the place where I live. And the morning I left home, I took water from my workplace and I took water from my home. And he showed the water from his workplace. It was pure, clean, lovely water. And the water that came out of his tap, which looked like Coca-Cola and smelled like turpentine. And he passed it up to the president of Suez at the front of the room, and he said, I challenge you to drink the water from these two bottles. You might imagine that the president of Suez declined and in fact got up and walked off the stage. But we were very powerfully there, and we actually took all the media. I mean, we were way more interesting than the corporate CEOs, right? And we said, you know, these folks like to tell you that the world consensus is here. Water is going to be privatized, commodified, put on the open market for sale, and it's the end of the debate. It's the end of history, as Fukuyama said, about economic globalization. Except, you know what, he was wrong. And economic globalization is not working, and almost everybody, except some few people who still will not deal with it, reality, are admitting that something is profoundly wrong with the system in which the world is dividing so deeply between rich and poor. I mean, it is happening so fast. China, there is such a wealth class that's been created, and there's been such devastation for ordinary Chinese people with their new miracle. As anybody but somebody who's just got blinkers on has got to see this is working. While we were there to say, you forgot to ask the people of the world. We don't agree that the world is going to privatize its water. We say water belongs to the earth. It doesn't belong to us, as a matter of fact. It belongs to other species. It belongs to all people. It's a fundamental human right. It must be guarded as a public trust by governments for all time. And we said, this is our truth, and we're here to speak it to you. And I tell you, we are winning this fight. I know it doesn't feel like it at the moment, but we are winning this ethically, environmentally, and even, I can argue, very powerfully economically. And I will tell you that in Uruguay, which is one of the poorer countries in Latin America, they just passed a year and a week ago, they had an election, they had a plebiscite to get a referendum on the election, and the referendum passed brilliantly, a two-thirds majority. It's basically calling for and demanding and requiring a constitutional amendment so that water is declared a human right, not to be delivered on a for-profit basis, and not to be denied to anyone for inability to pay in their country. And the water companies are leaving. This issue of water, and I say we're going to go to war over water in our world, or we're not. Right now, I have to tell you, on my bad days, I think we're going to go to war. I think there are going to be small wars, and I think they're going to be large wars, because people are coming in and stealing water and polluting water and destroying water and denying other people water. But I have a dream that maybe it could be very different, and that water could become nature's gift to humanity to teach us how to live with each other, finally, and how to live in harmony with nature. if we could just listen to water, if we can taste water, if we can see it, if we can understand each other's human need for water, if we can understand the earth's need for water, perhaps it's going to be this gift. And it's going to connect us to Americans and other people around the world who are fighting governments, Americans who feel just as strongly about what George Bush is doing as we do, and feel as colonized and taken over as he does, as we do, by this agenda. This is going to be a binding issue for us. I'm working with wonderful people in a group called Save Our Groundwater in Barrington, New Hampshire, who just look like you, like they're just sort of wonderful people who just care. They said I go to these meetings and they all feel like a Council of Canadians meeting to me. You know, they have the same language, the same analysis, the same anger about what's happening. And I find this a deeply binding a spiritual kind of connection that's taking place, and that water can be this gift. We have to stand up for it. You are fighting a very important fight here. It's more than the particular fight in your particular community. You have now become part of a world movement. It's a world movement whose time has come. It's a world movement that's going to win. And I swear to you, we won't rest until that happens. Thank you very much.
Maud Barlow, Canadian water rights activist with the Council of Canadians and International Forum on Globalization. Well, what about our water? Come and learn how to protect our local water resources from corporate exploitation at a community water rights protection workshop being held June 9th and 10th at the Rural Urban Center, 208 Broadway in Montour Falls. The program is sponsored by members of the Finger Lakes Progressive Coalition and the Finger Lakes Group of the Sierra Club. The workshop is designed for the general public to learn what can be done to prevent privatization of municipal water supplies and water mining in the Finger Lakes. The workshop will be led by two nationally known activists on community water issues. Their presentations will show what communities can do when municipal water and sewer services are targeted for corporate takeovers and when local water resources are targeted by water bottling companies, as they have been from Mount Shasta, California, to Bigelow Mountain in Maine. The workshop is being held the evening of Friday, June 9th, and the day of Saturday, June 10th, at the Rural Urban Center, 208 Broadway in Montour Falls. It's free and open to the public. There is a suggested donation of $10 on Saturday with a $5 charge for Saturday lunch. The Friday night session will include the screening of a documentary film, Thirst. The workshop schedule is at ecobooks.com/fingerlakeswaterworkshop.html, ecobooks.com/fingerlakeswaterworkshop.html. Contact Rachel to reserve a space at area code 607-569-2114, 569-2114, or email Rachel at ecobooks.com, Rachel at ecobooks.com, ecobooks.com. I'll post a copy of this info at our website, unwelcomeguest.org, where you can also download MP3s and podcasts of this and previous shows. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
To help these poor workers, the rich